Bonjour, adieu, ciao, kia ora. Welcome and greetings to On the Brink Radio, broadcast number 309. This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson, recording this from lovely Golden Bay on the South Island of New Zealand, in Takaka. You're going to hear the sounds of some sheep back behind me here. You might hear the sound of some little bumblebees as they come through the garage where I'm sitting now. I've rescued dozens of them over the past week or two. They come against the window here, and it might even be that I've rescued the same one more than once, but it's very, very cool. They become my little friends. It's very interesting. Today is the 1st of February, 2020, tomorrow being Groundhog Day. And you might think of that film with Bill Murray where he kept experiencing the same day over and over again. And it was like he was stuck in kind of a time loop thing. And apparently that has something to do with a Gurdjieffian belief about this thing called recurrence. It's not exactly like reincarnation, but anyway, I've just been reading some stuff from my friend on a Jeff Rentz video where he was interviewing this guy, supposedly, that worked for the NSA, the CIA, and all these other different secret intelligence organizations on this ultra-high-tech, artificially intelligence-based remote neural manipulation scenario, which is really nothing new. We're talking about mind manipulation and mind control that all these exotic technological apparati have been in development all through the 20th century. But anyway, with nanotechnology and trying to predict and determine your behavior and implant thoughts, kind of like Minority Report. And sure, I'm sure they think they're really doing that and stuff, but I'm just thinking of the implications of that for a Groundhog Day scenario, where if they kind of manipulated someone into experiencing the same day over and over again, or kind of like in that movie The Truman Show that Peter Weir produced, where the character kept repeat having the same experiences over and over, like the woman on the bicycle would go past every few hours. And he finally realized that it wasn't actually a normally occurring environment that he was in, but he came to realize that he was actually living, his whole life was the set of a TV show. Now, that has interesting implications for the Matrix reality of today, but anyway, none of this has anything to do, or very little to do, with today's show. And my heart is with my friends and family and all my relations in Australia now more than ever. The fires are still going on. A lot of them have been put out or severely reduced in severity due to rain. But the onslaught of what I call textbook geophysical warfare experiment continues to unfold, with not only the fires, with all kinds of anomalous behaviors, but dust storms, you name it, every possible thing. And then, now, with the weird virus outbreak in Wuhan, China, that I still don't really know what to really believe about all that, but apparently the city is locked down, and I don't know how many people have... I can't trust any of the statistics. I mean, apparently something really is going on, but I'm sure it's not what we're being told. But apparently, according to many credible mainstream news sources, China has stopped all foreign tourism. So they're not letting anybody out of the country to go on tour. So that means Australia's going to lose... Well, they typically have 1.5 million people from China to come to Australia every year. And so, and I'm guessing, I mean, you know, the tourism industry, of which Scott Morrison used to be head of Tourism Australia. Tourism Australia would have statistics on the approximate value or gross domestic product that each visiting Chinese tourist would bring. But I'm guessing, when you think about the price of plane tickets and accommodation, and if each person only stayed a couple of weeks, which is probably what they do, that's probably at least about $10,000 per person. So that's annually in Australia, this is a very rough estimate, but you'd have 1.5 million people each bringing in $10,000 into the Australian economy. I mean, I'm guessing if they, you know, who knows if they fly on a Chinese airline or an Australian airline. But anyway, you're talking a lot of money. And now that they've canceled all the Chinese tourism for at least the next 2 months, that's going to be 20% of that whole figure that Australia's tourism industry and economy is going to lose. And I go like, well, sure, that's a blow, but honest to God, as big of an enemy as I've become of the tourism industry, and especially in Australia, over the 2 decades that I've been traveling there, and the way that Australia has become such a bloated economic monster in recent years, with prices of stuff just going out the roof, and even people from Europe observing on how expensive stuff is, and just everything, and it's kind of like this is all kind of a karmic payback. You know, and my friend Tanya, who lives up near Bellingen in New South Wales, she's Australian. She observed that all these fires and stuff, that it's the karma for 200 years of just some of the most radical abuse of the land and the indigenous people that this planet has ever seen. But if you're talking about people's karma, then yes. But the really dangerous and sick and sad aspect, and this is what has made me comment on echoes of the Hopi prophecy of the Day of Purification, that whatever Mother Earth has to do to get rid of us, it's going to have a very dire effect on all the other innocent, beautiful little life forms who are already suffering because of us. It's what's happened in Australia has been a perfect foreshadowing of that, a perfect smaller scale, not a planetary conflagration, but a large portion of a continent with untold millions and millions of non-human lives lost and injured, animals laying there in pain and suffering even now, burned koalas, and the three main species, I haven't really had a chance to look into this too much, but the three main species that are some of the hardest hit are the koalas, of course, the lyrebirds, and a glossy black cockatoo. These are ones that whose habitat was, their known habitat area has largely been completely destroyed. But interestingly, just almost, I don't really want to use the word superficially, because with the heat, apparently this heat was extraordinary, and it might have damaged some of the soil microbes that might hinder the regeneration of the forest in the way that it always has, actually benefited from fire. But what it has enabled is the timber industry to go in there and just get the wood that's, I mean, if you think about it, it's almost like it was strategically planned. Because what could be better for the timber industry than to have all the stuff that they don't want removed ahead of time, all the branches and the leaves and the foliage and stuff that they have to chop off, and that's a big part of the timber industry's getting rid of all that stuff. So to have flamethrowers come in and just do that dirty work ahead of time, and then to just have unlimited access to go in and chop down all these forests and trees and areas where previously logging would never have been thought of or allowed, but now, because the land, it's in a high fire risk danger, of course, because the fire just came through, 100% probability. Now they're going like, well, you know, look, all these trees are just standing there. Why don't we just go ahead and chop them down? But I think this was part of the plan all along. Part of the strategically premeditated geophysical warfare land grab scenario. But this, as important as all this is and near and dear to my heart, and I'll be returning to Australia in about a month and a half, probably directly to Tasmania. Today's show is a topic, it's probably the biggest topic that anyone could ever talk about. It's about what we call
space.
And the show is called Space. And there's a bit of humor in that, but it's really funny because when you think of space, I mean, truly, space is the biggest, it's an astronomically huge concept. And is it a place? Is it a concept? Is it in our mind? I mean, and so I'm always observing that people have seemed to be obsessed with space. And in recent decades, in my lifetime, in fact, I was actually born right at the dawn of the space age. So I'm fully qualified as a space cadet. Actually, a high-ranking space cadet. But we talk about that we need or we want to go into space. And I'm always going like, but look, we're already there. Where's the Earth? The Earth is in space. I mean, where else? Is there anywhere that's not in space? Anywhere on the Earth's in space. And so, therefore, everything on or in the Earth or around the Earth is also in space. And where's the Sun? The Sun's in space. And the Sun, the Earth's in the solar system's in the galaxy. The galaxy consists mostly of space, but where's the galaxy? The galaxy's also in space. I mean, this is all quite abstract when you really think about it, because in the same way that from the perspective of an individual person walking around on the Earth, it can seem quite flat. And in fact, a lot of it actually is flat up to a certain point. You know, you can look out across the Nullarbor Plain or different desert areas, a field, just like where you might live. You can look out, and for all practical purposes, it is flat. It can be as flat as a sheet of paper. So on the scale that we experience on as an individual person, the Earth can be flat, but it doesn't mean that you can walk over and throw your Coke bottle off the edge of it like the guy and the gods must be crazy. So I think that we do have pretty credible evidence that the Earth is an oblate spheroidal planetary entity. We don't really know what the shape of the Earth would be without the ocean. I've actually seen a computer model of that, and if it's accurate, it looks kind of like a potato. It's kind of knobby. It's got kind of a waist. It's got a bulge at the poles and kind of a waist in the middle. Kind of like a potato crossed with a dumbbell. So if that's the true shape of the Earth, but so the Earth, it has always been in space, and so have we. We're actually travelers in space and time on spaceship Earth. And I believe that expression it's attributed to Adlai Stevenson, a very interesting sort of educator, highly intelligent politician from the JFK era. So we talk about the space race, personal space, inner space, outer space. We've got different scales of space. We've got the space between your ears. We've got the space of the inside of your house, or the cubic volume of your refrigerator or your Esky. The space of your lot that you might buy, that's a surface area. We've got the cubic volume, which would be the space of the ocean, which is huge. And we've got the space, you know how they've got the EEZ, the exclusive economic zone of a country, is the area out around its continental boundary that goes out into the ocean. Like New Zealand's got the fourth or fifth largest EEZ in the world, and Australia's got the second largest. France has the largest because of its maritime territories. But what if the Earth had a spherical EEZ that would go out? And so in the same way, when I was just interviewing an astronomer in Nelson a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about how if a space probe was descending down through the atmosphere of Jupiter, one of the gas giants, that the notion of it eventually reaching a surface is meaningless, because it might have a rocky core, but you wouldn't really all of a sudden hit a surface in the same way that you would if something was coming through the atmosphere of the Earth. It would go through the atmosphere, and then there's the relatively solid discontinuity reaching the surface, the soil, the sand, the water, the Earth, the mountain, the rock. With Jupiter, you would just have increasing density until your space probe might get stuck because of the density, the viscosity. But in that same way, going outward from the Earth, out through the atmosphere, the increasingly tenuous stratosphere, mesosphere, ionosphere, the electrically charged areas, the magnetosphere, the heliopause. So where does the boundary of the Earth's atmosphere actually stop, and where does space begin? So really, you can't really, it's all kind of an abstract artifact of our imagination to imagine the boundary of space, because truly, we're in space all the time. Everything we think, do, and say is in space. So we're all travelers in space and time. We're all space cadets. So there's so many different interesting aspects to this thing with space. This show is probably going to be more kind of like an outline of really cool topics. But there's a lot of belief in ancient cosmologies and in modern day people that we came from space, or that life came from space. That's a theory called panspermia, that life came here on comets or asteroids or somehow. And even Francis Crick, that was one of the co-founders of the DNA helical model in the 1950s, he wrote a book about how that life here, I think it was supposed to be science fiction, but it was about how DNA was actually created by scientists on another planet and sent here on some kind of space probe to seed life here. And that makes me think of an interesting encounter I had with this astronomer in Nelson about a month ago named Duncan Steele. He's I thought of him as a legendary comet and asteroid researcher who my astronomer friends in Australia put me on to. We finally caught up, and I recorded an interview with him talking about his work with comets and asteroids, but he's pretty much left all that behind about 25 years ago, and now he's working for a satellite company in Nelson called Xerra, X-E-R-R-A, which is actually a New Zealand government entity based on the manipulation of satellite data and all of that's implications. And Duncan's background's actually in optics and physics, so, and he's not someone that likes to look through telescopes or look at the stars. He likes to look at computer screens and manipulate data and information and stuff. Well, anyway, an idea that I saw on his website was that he was, and I thought it was a joke, he's advocating that humans seed Mars, the planet, with genetically modified organisms, so that there'll be a second planet with life. And I couldn't take this seriously until I talked with him in person, and he verified that yes, he does think this is a good idea. So to me, the more I've thought about that, it's one of the most heinous, ludicrous, and insidious things I think that humanity could possibly do. And I'm calling him Dr. Frankensteel now in honor of this whole scenario. But I'm not really going to go into that on this show, although it does relate to the space thing, our relationship with other planets in the solar system and our ability. I'm not going to say our ability to go there, because I don't personally think that humans can travel outside the orbit of the Earth, even though a lot of time and expense and energy has been put into convincing us otherwise. I personally don't think that we can. I think that the dangers from the radiation, the Van Allen radiation belts, the cosmic rays continually bombarding, which is a very intense field of particles coming not only from the sun, but from extrasolar and even extragalactic sources too. Even people that spend a lot of time in high altitude planes are subject to very highly increased rates of cancer and genetic and genomal damage because of the radiation bombardment. So any living being trying to be in space for long outside the Earth's atmosphere in orbital space, and I guess that's really the difference between there's the space of being inside the womb of Mother Earth's protective environment, which is where we're meant to live, where we've always lived, and getting outside that, where we were never really meant to go. That's where the danger comes in. I think that that's even a violation of the Hopi prophecy up there with, if we dig precious things from the land, we will invite disaster. And one of the things that could happen once we've dug precious things from the land is that if we weren't ever meant to go into space, you know, and there's something about in the Hopi prophecy about a house in the sky. And whenever that happens, that means the day of purification is near. So it's like they've, in their collective memory, they've seen all this stuff before. And we're probably talking pre-Atlantis, pre-Lemurian, maybe previous incarnations of civilization from a really long time ago. So for as far back as we can go into our collective psyche, we've got memories and then we've got stories and history of looking at the stars, an astronomical naked eye astronomy perspective, and what this means, who the stars are. We think of them as being magical places from far, far away, where our ancestors came from, possibly, and where other beings have come from. The whole thing of aliens and UFOs and how this kind of thing is a theme that runs through the myths, legends, story, and history of almost all ancient people up there, that this common cultural archetype of beings from space or origin from out there somewhere is up there also with Velikovsky's observation of myths, legends, and stories of planetary devastation due to cosmic events like comets and asteroids and things like floods and volcanism and large-scale disaster that our ancestors weren't sure if they were going to survive through. So these are two common and interrelated interesting threads in the archetypal, mapping the archetypal psychic dimensions of our species. So we've looked at the stars and always had a sense of wonder. And on the 15th of February, it'll be 20 years since I first came down under and set foot in New Zealand. And it was probably about a week or two after that. It would have been late February when I was hitchhiking to the far north. And in Ahapara, I went out onto a sand dune at night and turned around and looked up at the sky. And I was just blown completely away by seeing the brightest part of the Milky Way on a beautiful, crystal clear summer night that I'd never seen before. That image will always be emblazoned in my mind. So inspiring. And so that, seeing that has to be one of the most powerful archetypal things in all of the human psyche. And when you think about it, it's not just a pretty picture. Our retinas are actually receiving, based on the contemporary model of the astrophysical universe, when we look at stars, including the sun, we're actually, onto our retina is falling photons that have been traveling for thousands or millions of light years to come from those different distant stars and galaxies and nebulae. So when you think of it, not only are we actually made of stardust, we're actually receiving and ingesting light photon particles from all these different galaxies into our eyes and into our brains all the time. It's very, very interesting. I guess the main thing I wanted to talk about with the whole thing with space is the militarization and the weaponization of space. And I think that, you know, probably as far back as people had weapon systems from the dawn of what we call civilization, people have they've seen things happening in the sky and thought of that as the gods, theomachy, war of the gods, bolts of thunder and lightning being hurled and storms and devastation and things like that. And people wanted to emulate the gods and the leaders of the ancient cultures. This is Velikovsky, wanted to emulate the gods of destruction. And so therefore, that's been our unconscious drive behind our increasingly advanced weapon systems. And people would go, well, you know, like if you're fighting battles, you want to seek the high ground because it gives you the advantage. You've got the strategic perspective, the viewpoint, the ability to look down and see what the approaching people are doing. You can defend your hill and stuff. And so I think space, orbital space, was seen as the ultimate sort of high ground. And I believe that Well, I think it was the Nazis with Peenemünde and Wernher von Braun that built the first actual rockets. And I don't think they, I'm not sure how high they went. We had the V-2 that was a weapon of terror and could drop down and blow things up. And I don't know how actually high it went. I don't know if it actually was a space-faring vehicle. But then with the when they imported the Nazis into America, NASA was formed, and Wernher von Braun developed the first rockets that put in the first satellite, which I think was Vanguard. And then the Explorer satellites, which were actually instrumentation designed to measure what happened in the Earth's magnetic fields when they detonated these hydrogen bombs in the ionosphere as part of what they call Operation Argus in 1958. So this was really, this was the dawn of the space age. Wasn't us going there, it was us exploding hydrogen bombs in it. And so, you know, I guess really, if you really want to talk about space, we have to talk about the history of astronomy as well. The history of how long people have been looking at the stars, the planets, when the planets were first identified. The word planetos in Greek, it means wanderer. So our ancient knowledge about stars and comets and asteroids and supernovae and the sun and the moon and the relationship with the tides and the auroras and the seasons and all this stuff relates to space. Which is, like I said, it's the biggest topic there is. And so, if we look at a history of astronomy, and how our whole worldview has evolved with the relativistic, the Doppler shift of the galaxies, and how we think that everything's receding, and the idea of the Big Bang, and the origins of life, astrobiology, and all of our knowledge about astrophysics, and then planetary atmospheres, and the... I've been really privileged in the past week or two to be able to correspond with Bill Napier, who, along with Victor Klüb, are the two most legendary comet researchers I know of on this whole planet. They formulated a paper in 1981 or 82 called A Theory of Coherent Catastrophism, in which they put forth the idea that the mass extinction events that the Earth is believed to have experienced were initiated by impacts from a comet or asteroid. And they actually wrote a letter to William and Louis Alvarez, who were kind of doing research along that line. And then the Alvarez team basically stole their thunder and ran with this idea, and then they discovered the iridium layer and put forth the idea of at least the mass extinction sequence of 65 million years ago was initiated by a comet or asteroid impact. They got all the credit for it. Klüb and Napier, their perspective goes far beyond looking at just one event. They look at the whole motion of the solar system within the galaxy and how that brings us into what they call episodic bombardment and cometary waves. And this is just very, very, very interesting. So all this comes under the category of space. But for the more implications of what its effect on us is right now, not counting the long-term effects and impacts of not only physical bombardment, but energetic bombardment from supernova emanations, cosmic rays, and coronal mass ejections and solar flares and other unexpected, the Earth passing through plasma fields or regions of different electromagnetic density, passing through the tail of a comet, all this different kind of stuff that is par for the course for life on this planet. But we've had the protective envelope, the womb of Mother Earth's atmosphere, that is, it's not right to say it was designed for us to live in, but it's what we've always lived within it. And so who and what we are is a product and a function of being within Mother Earth, who is herself the most amazing spaceship that could ever exist. So we don't need to go in space, we're already there. But we're endangering Mother Earth by our attempts to go into space and to weaponize space. And this is one of the things that Dr. Rosalie Bertell talked about extensively in her book, Planet Earth, Latest Weapons of War, that the work of Dr. Claudia von Werloff is carrying on now. So this has a lot to do with the world of today, we've had rockets and satellites that have been going up for a long time. We've had astronauts since, like, I think 1961 with Yuri Gagarin, and then John Glenn, first man to orbit the Earth, Alan Shepard, all these people. You know, it was just somehow important to have somebody up there even just for a few minutes. But, and then we've had the Mercury and Gemini missions, and then all the cosmonauts from Russia. And so I believe that it's real that we've had people in orbit. Now we've got the International Space Station and probably other stuff that we don't know about. We've got who knows how many satellites are up there, probably tens of thousands. There's ones that don't work anymore that are still there. There's ones that have been broken up and fragments and junk, things that have been discarded. Just like on the top of Mount Everest, low orbital space would be sort of like, would have the summit of Everest syndrome, only probably to the third power, the amount of debris orbiting there, like a whole cloud. I mean, it's probably uncertain, probably closer to an equatorial orbits, but and then there's all the top secret spy satellites and weapons, and now they're getting ready to launch this whole new, apparently thousands of satellites related to the 5G thing. So who knows what all this really is, that Elon Musk's SpaceX is going to be putting these up, and apparently has already started, but now some of that's going to be done by a company called Rocket Lab, which most people don't know is actually owned by Lockheed Martin, who is the biggest defense contractor in the world. They've got a huge presence in New Zealand. They actually run New Zealand's military, especially in the wake of the Christchurch quake in 2011. They host a biannual weapons conference in Auckland. They're one of the biggest makers of nuclear missiles, of satellites. They own the patents for deep seabed mining. They run cybersecurity for the U.S. government and the Pentagon. They're corporate economy is bigger and more powerful and influential than the government of all but about a dozen and a half countries on this whole planet. So Lockheed Martin owns Rocket Lab, who have launching facilities on the East Cape. And I just saw last week where Rocket Lab, which is really Lockheed, is actually paying for this multi-million dollar revitalization of this really cool, quaint little town called Wairoa that's kind of on the way from Gisborne, if you want to go to Lake Waikaremoana. They're going to build all these information facilities and this kind of a data hub and all this sort of, it's sort of like the high-speed rail thing, only for the information highway. So this is the future of New Zealand that's being rolled out. So when we talk about space, this Duncan Steele dude, Dr. Frankensteel, he's also apparently, I'll use the word expert, even though to his credit, I have to say he didn't refer to himself as an expert, but he's probably an authority on space junk and satellites and stuff. But it was really weird that when I did the interview with him, it was about him as a comet and asteroid guy, but only when I met him did I learn what he's doing now. So then when I started thinking of a whole new set of even more relevant things to talk with him about, he and his company sort of blew me off. It's like they accused me of being rude when they wouldn't cooperate, which I wasn't, but it led to a whole interesting chain reaction of, it's kind of like a denial that they really weren't interested in talking about what they do. But any company like that is going to be involved with military industrial stuff, satellite mapping, like of the ocean floor, the mapping of land and territory for all kinds of nefarious purposes, the mapping of resources, the mapping of the motion of, for example, things that happen on the ocean. And now this could be very useful if you're monitoring, for example, illegal trawling or fishing, but also to show the location of any vessel on the ocean, which is very critical in my work with understanding whale and dolphin strandings. My friend at Stranded No More always found a correlation between the relative proximity of some kind of military industrial hazardous operation or activity relatively close to where any whale or dolphin strandings happen. So if we were able to have satellite information that showed the presence of, for example, all the geophysical exploration vehicles, any military vessel, especially submarines, I just read that China's developing a laser satellite that can detect submarines down to 500 meters in depth. So, I mean, that's information that the public's really not supposed to have. And so, but I think that's the kind of thing this company is involved in. And also, in passing, the head scientist of this company, whose name I won't say, actually worked at Oak Ridge National Lab for 10 years. He's like a computer geek that developed this, a computer system that it's related to the whole idea of the Internet of Things and Ocean of Things, where everything has its own unique identifying number to go in this giant global simulation program. But his project was involved in doing an extremely high-resolution cartographic survey, in other words, a remapping of the whole Earth's surface, which I'm guessing includes the seabed, at the highest level of resolution that's ever been done. And I think this is an ongoing project. So this guy was one of the masterminds of that, and he's the head scientist at Zira, along with Duncan Steele as the head research scientist. So what these people are up to that they won't talk about is a matter of speculation, but I'm going to be going into that later. But this all relates to the space thing. I personally do not believe that anybody went to the moon. I don't think that Wernher von Braun said he didn't think that biological life could survive passing through the Van Allen radiation belts. And it could be that they did it, tried to do it, but I don't think that the life forms, it's just like with a lot of things. You could get exposed to a lethal dose of radiation, but you might not die. You might not get sick or die for quite a while. It might take a while depending on the dose. So the same could be said for traveling in space and going through the Van Allen belts, that it may not kill people instantly. But when you look at medical research now on astronauts and people that have spent a lot of time in space, it's very, very, very serious. And people are talking about how there's no way Elon Musk is going to go to Mars because he can't. He can't protect people from radiation, especially not on the surface of Mars, much less getting there. And so now the whole thing comes in of, well, are they going to be transhuman people that are not fully human in order to withstand the radiation? So we've got all the issues of people going into space, what we're doing with space, the whole weapons in space thing. This really flared up with Reagan in the 1980s and his thing of what he called Star Wars, the Strategic Defense Initiative, to put... Well, they were, as they, you know, in the same way that they changed the name of the Department of War to the Department of Defense after World War II in honor of Orwell and Goebbels, the SDI, the Strategic Defense Initiative, and its accompanying Strategic Computing Initiative were all about, they said, creating a shield to go over America to protect America from incoming Russian nuclear missiles. But what it was really about is creating an offensive weapon from space that would be the ultimate weapon system that could shoot down beams, that could knock out cities and stuff from orbit and take out power stations and cities and nuclear missiles and aircraft and anything like that. And I think all this has just been developing and running off the rail, and it all depends on computers. Artificial intelligence, solid state entity network that's able to operate all these extremely complex systems and run the simulations. And just like in the same way of orchestrating and operating the geophysical warfare operation, like what has been going on in Australia, for example, also involves a lot of stuff from space. Even the ionospheric mirrors that are created from the microwaves of things like HARP and JORN and ISCAT and the Harold Holt facility at Exmouth, all these things. The ionosphere is actually the border between what we call low orbital space and the Earth's troposphere where we live. And beyond weapons in space and astronomy and understanding of planetary atmospheres, there's the whole idea of mining asteroids. And you know, if Lockheed has patents on deep seabed mining. They've also got patents for technology to mine asteroids. But I mean, like that, and like contaminating Mars with GMOs, and the people like Dr. Duncan Frankensteel. This is like the Nazis impregnating women with gorilla semen, or Edward Teller blasting a harbor in Alaska with a hydrogen bomb, or Elon Musk terraforming Mars with hydrogen bombs, or Cornelius Rhodes injecting people with cancer in Puerto Rico. It's like the Brotherhood of Death carried into space. And so Loren Isley, the naturalist, had a brilliant comparison between the Earth, the humans, as he calls us, the spore bearers or the world eaters. And he said that the form of life that humanity most closely resembled from all his decades of study in nature was the Myxomycophyta, the cellular slime molds. That is, it's like a slug of mold that goes all over the floor of the forest, and it consumes all these rotting leaves and plant matter, and then it consumes it all. And when it's eaten everything in its whole area, all these different sort of various pods of slug-like fungus material, they flow all back together like a slug and form this giant body, and then it puts out these stalks called a fruiting body, and it grows stalks, and then it has spores, and then all of a sudden, the spores explode and they scatter everywhere. So he said that us going into space is like the spores of the cellular slime mold being dispersed, because we're trying to go and spread our disease everywhere throughout the solar system and the galaxy. And if that's some kind of weird imperative of the Homo sapien macrovirus, I think it's probably going to represent the last straw for Mother Earth and the Great Spirit to cleanse the Earth of the Homo sapien macrovirus, which I think we've been calling for a long time. We don't have the ability to shut down the AI, automated warfare, geophysical, environmental warfare scenario, even if we wanted to. We pretty much agreed on that. Then we've got the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, SETI. And I'm always talking about how, you know, their beliefs are so limited. They think that anybody that's out there is going to be using microwaves and mathematics and stuff just like us. And I go like, but look, anybody that's truly intelligent would have probably never even developed that stuff to begin with. Just like the whales and dolphins, the ultimate indigenous people and a true extraterrestrial intelligence living on Mother Earth far longer than us in the ocean, with their own ability to communicate with water-based life on other planets and to be the primary guardians for life as we know her here. This is what I think is really going on. And I think that they're constantly beaming us right now, stronger than ever, sending beautiful healing energies to the Dreamtime ancestors of Australia, the whale dreaming people of the East Coast, who were the earliest people to become people, because the whales and dolphins taught us how to become people a long, long, long time ago when the Earth was green. She's still green and beautiful. Mother Earth is our beautiful mother and home. We should all be doing our best to love her as dearly as she's always loved us. Well, I guess I'd better go now. Hey there, brother. Who you jiving with that cosmic debris? That's Frank Zappa. All right, this is Jeff Phillips Wefferson signing off for On the Brink Radio. Remember, we don't have to go in space. We're already there. Good day.
Thank you. Thank you.